the Deco Retro program here on Planet FM. We will bring you interesting interviews, updates of future Deco, Modern, Retro, and other related events. Also the stories that celebrate New Zealand's history and its people, as well as book reviews and other snippets capturing the glamour and fascination of a bygone era.
Deco Retro, Deco Retro.
Good afternoon, listeners. I'm Philippa. The hymn written by William Whiting in 1860, For Those at Sea, seems particularly relevant to our program today about life and conditions for migrants on board the sailing ships making the perilous 3-month voyage to New Zealand in the mid-1800s. Every ship encountered terrifying storms, but other threats included shipwreck, fire, and icebergs. Passengers also had to endure the often confronting and unpleasant sights, sounds, and smells of daily life when confined in crowded conditions, never setting foot on terra firma for the entire duration of that epic 3-month voyage. Imagine then the overwhelming sense of relief and utter joy those migrants must have felt as they rushed up on deck to catch their first glimpse of Aotearoa looming majestically in the distance. Finally, their 3-month ordeal at sea was over, and they would soon make landfall in the country they and their descendants would call home. Later, their accounts of the voyage would pass into family folklore. My interest in this subject was aroused when exploring the contents of a small wooden trunk that had belonged to my father, I discovered my maternal great-grandparents' ticket to New Zealand on board the Andrew Jackson in 1865. William and Mary Louisa, together with their 3 sons aged 11, 9 and 7, settled in Auckland. The ticket cost £40. David Hastings, author of Over the Mountains of the Sea, is with me today to tell us about life on the migrant ships. Australian by birth, David married a Kiwi and has lived in Auckland for 30 years. He started out as a journalist for the Sun newspaper in Melbourne. Having made the move to Auckland, he joined the New Zealand Herald as sub-editor and later became editor of the Weekend Herald. He is now retired, but still teaches English as a second language. David has a master's degree in history from Auckland University, and his book, Over the Mountains of the Sea, was originally his master's thesis. Welcome, David. So glad you could join us today.
Thank you, Philippa.
Now, Julius Vogel's ambitious migration scheme is generally taken to be from 1870 to 1885, I'm quoting you here. At its peak, in the year to May 1875, the Vogel migration brought 31,785 people to New Zealand on 93 voyages, mostly on sailing ships. The aim was to increase the European population in New Zealand, but I also believe there was an imbalance of the sexes.
That's right. They put a very high priority on getting single women to come out because mostly they were lots of unmarried men, and they needed partners. They needed people, partly to become domestic servants, but later to become the mothers of the new nation. And it was actually quite difficult to persuade single women to make the voyage.
Yes. It would have been hard for them leaving their families.
That's right, yes.
Going into the world on their own. What else can you tell us about the scheme and how, you know, the people they chose to be assisted migrants?
They had a very particular idea about who should come and the type of people they wanted. They wanted robust farm worker type people, people who would break in the land and create a rural economy. They weren't so interested in people who were masters of the finer arts or anything like that. They really wanted people who had skills of working with the land and building and stuff like that.
Practical skills.
That's right, yes.
And how did they go about attracting the desirable migrants? Because I believe it was very competitive.
It was extremely competitive because the Australian colonies, or the Australian states as they are now, were also competing for the same kind of people. So were the North Americans, and to some extent the South Americans were as well. There was a great outpouring of people from Britain and Europe more generally during the 19th century, and the destination places, they all had this very particular idea of the kind of people they wanted.
And New Zealand was at a disadvantage with the being the furthest distance.
That's right.
To travel.
That's right. It was so far
so
away.
So far.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Now, I know at that time there was this huge diaspora of people pouring out of Europe from the 1840 onwards. And the Irish, of course, were leaving because of the potato famine. But what were some of the other reasons that people chose to leave?
Well, there were all sorts of reasons that people left. And I suppose you talk in general terms, people leave for economic reasons,
yes,
don't they?
They
leave because they're hoping to be able to make a better life somewhere else. But there were all sorts of strange personal reasons. One of my favourites was a man on a ship called the Terpsichore, who was a German migrant, and he was migrating to New Zealand because he'd heard that it was much easier to get a divorce in New Zealand than it is back in Germany. And when historians talk about general theories of migration, these little vignettes of strange, quirky reasons for doing things tend to get lost.
I think he just wanted to abandon his family and not be found again.
I think that's probably right. But among the single women, another reason was unwanted pregnancy.
Yes.
They'd be bundled off on the ship to get them out of the way.
And I suppose some women, older spinsters maybe, might have been looking for husbands, do you think? Well, not so much.
I think that's possible.
Mm. Well, not older spinsters, that's a bit...
Yeah.
to say that.
Yeah, I'm sure that, in fact, that's true. I mean, there's a diary that I read from a woman called Jane Finlayson, and she discusses this at great lengths, actually. And some of them hope that they're going to meet a partner on the ship, but the regulations on the ship were so tightly controlled that the single women were always kept away from the single men on the ship.
I know.
So they got no chance to socialise.
What I wanted to ask you about, the class distinction on those ships was strictly observed. How were they separated? Life was a microcosm of the status quo, I suppose, of what people, as it was in England.
Well, that's right. If you look at the deck layout of a 19th century passenger ship, it's divided along class lines. It's a sort of upstairs, downstairs. Downstairs in the steerage is where the poor people are, and upstairs in the cabin is where the people who've got money are.
Yes.
And the space was further divided according to basically marital status. So if you were below decks, a steerage passenger, and you were a single man, your compartment was in the front part of the ship. If you were a single woman, your compartment was at the stern of the ship underneath the cabin, and if you were married with children, you occupied the middle part. And this was quite rigorously policed to try and keep this separation going.
Mm, very cramped conditions.
Yeah.
Now, could you tell us about the Virgin's Cage, as it was known, to which single women and widows were consigned?
Yeah.
So to speak. And also, about the ambivalent Victorian attitude towards women in general.
Yes, well, the Virgin's Cage was a sailor's term for the single women's compartment, which is this area under the back of the back of the ship, which was essentially, the best way I can think of describing it is as a kind of protective custody to protect them from the predations of the men on board.
All right.
But there is another way of looking at it, and that it was a bit like a prison, and that was to protect everybody else on board from the excesses of the single women who sometimes tried to break out of their cages and, in fact, sometimes did. Part of the sort of the Victorian mental attitude towards women was either they were weak and vulnerable and needed protection, hence the protective custody theory, or they were wild and dangerous and the cause of chaos and uncertainty, hence the imprisonment theory.
Dangerous temptresses.
That's right. And they weren't, and in fact, there was a mixture of all kinds of people.
Mm.
And in the single women's cage, the Virgin's Cage, as they called it, some of them were married women with children going out to join their husbands. You know, the mixture of people in there was more complex than the term implies, and also the regulations imply. It was actually an incredibly cruel thing.
I know. I mean, unthinkable to us today.
Yeah, what you have to understand about it is that they were locked up at night. Every night when the sun went down, they were all taken off herded off the deck and locked in the compartment. And if you can imagine being locked in a stuffy compartment when the ship was in the tropics, the ventilation is poor, the sanitary conditions are not very good. It was awful, and they had the worst time of anybody.
Well, most people's idea of absolute hell, if you were claustrophobic at all,
that's right,
you would go I wonder if many people lost their minds.
Well,
perhaps not. Perhaps they just took laudanum.
Well, they protested, actually. A lot of the time they would protest wildly.
Yes.
And they would make a lot of noise. They would basically disturb the rest of the ship and say, give us relief.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're going to disturb your rest as well.
So cruel.
And the other contradictory thing about it, of course, was that there was tremendous concern about disease and epidemics on the ship, and they went to inordinate lengths to try to make sure that nobody, say, with measles or scarlet fever got on the ship, and they tried to keep the compartments all carefully ventilated. This was a sort of public health measure. And yet all of this was completely contradicted in their treatment of the single women. Because apart from anything else, those compartments must have been a breeding ground for disease.
Oh, yes. And, I mean, imagine if the ship was going down. Unless somebody acted quickly, they'd go down with the ship, wouldn't they?
That's right, yeah.
I mean, because you'd never get them out in time.
They were locked inside, yeah.
Oh, that's horrific to think of.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to come to the sanitary conditions on board, because they must have been ghastly and the stench are absolutely overwhelming. They apart from people bringing disease on board with them, those conditions, you know, sewerage and what have you, contamination, that must have added to dangerous you know, dangers, made the voyage dangerous in its own way as well.
Well, I guess so. But, I mean, they did have plumbing on the ships.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, they did.
Oh, right.
But sometimes it broke down, and when it did, it wasn't very pretty.
I just thought they had buckets or something.
They actually had water closets.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm glad to hear
that. Yeah.
But they didn't have enough of them.
No, they didn't have certainly didn't have enough of them.
No. And of course, the other problem was for women who had to give birth during
the
voyage.
Yes.
And this happened quite a lot, I believe.
Yeah, lots of children were born on the ships, and often they took the name of the ship. The one that I remember is a girl called Catherine Holmes, and her middle name was Chili, because that was the name of the ship. She was christened Catherine Chili Holmes.
Mm. And the death rate for children, would that have been quite high?
Well, you've got to put it in a little bit of perspective. It to us, it seems shockingly high.
Mm.
There was one voyage, well, there were twin voyages of two ships called the Scimitar and the Mongol, which lost 20 and 26 children apiece during sort of 3 months voyages.
Gosh.
And they are shocking figures.
Yes.
But compared to earlier periods, they weren't quite as bad. And they certainly weren't as bad as some of the figures of people crossing the Atlantic in the Irish diaspora, right. For instance, in the earlier in the 19th century.
Yes.
And this is partly because of the regulations that they introduced to try and control the public health measures on the ships.
And also, like the Vogel scheme, they would have lost a lot of money with people dying, the assisted ones dying.
Well, there was... absolutely.
That wouldn't be good. Not good for a captain's career.
Cold, hard economic interest took...
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously played a part. But
yes. But
the other side of it was, of course, the publicity.
Mm.
New Zealand was so far away that stories of scores of people dying on the voyage were not going to go
down very well. That wouldn't have attracted people.
No.
Now, most of those migrants were landlubbers, and so those mountainous waves would have been especially terrifying. But what were some of the other dangers they faced, you know?
Well, they faced the full range of dangers of travelling at sea in the 19th century. And
I guess fire would have been the worst.
Probably the most terrifying,
yes.
And they were wooden ships. If the ship caught fire and the fire got into the rigging, you had a big, big problem.
Yeah.
And, of course, famously, there was one ship called the Cospatrick. It caught fire off Cape Town, and it went down with almost all hands. There were three survivors in the end, but it was something like 470 people died.
Oh, died!
It was the Titanic of its era.
Would they have thrown themselves off?
They were jumping into the sea, and like the Titanic, there were issues with the lifeboats.
Mm.
There clearly weren't enough lifeboats on the ship, and when the ship started to heel over, you couldn't launch them properly.
No, and of course, now the Strathmore. Is that the one that sank? Are you talking about the Cospatrick?
No, the Cospatrick caught fire and sank. The Strathmore ran aground on some lonely little rocks right in the middle of the Southern Ocean between South Africa and Australia. And people survived that. They managed to cling to the rocks for safety, but they lived like Robinson Crusoes for 6 months before they were rescued. Yes, yes.
My goodness. What stories they would have to pass down to
indeed,
their
yes.
future generations. Yeah. Now, the captain and the medical surgeon were the two most powerful people. I mean, their word was law. But there were some captains who were rather negligent, apparently. And I remember reading that there was one captain who was blind drunk the entire voyage. He navigated in the wrong direction, the yeah, I hope I'm getting this right. The officers took over because he could, and
I don't think.
I think he dropped dead before making.
He died. He died before he made land.
He died before he made land.
He was in a terrible way, and the ship, that ship ran aground as well. But they managed to get it off the sandy bottom off Brazil. He was meandering round and round in circles.
Extraordinary.
And eventually there was essentially a mutiny, and and the first officer took over. And the ship, you know, the normal voyage was about 95 days.
Yes.
This voyage took 140, 150.
Oh, my goodness. And the food would have run out.
The food had run out. By the time they reached Invercargill, they were eating the rats.
Oh.
Rat pie.
Well, there would have been plenty of them.
Yeah, rat pie had become favourite on the menu.
Oh, you would never forget it. In fact, you'd never recover.
Yeah, well.
Yes. Well, speaking of rats, I was going to ask you about the food that they supplied, which to our modern minds sounds absolutely revolting in the health-conscious age we live in now, and also with no refrigeration. So would there have been a big discrepancy between thirst and steerage?
Well, yeah, food is one of the key ways that you could tell the difference whether you were first class or steerage. The steerage people basically ate it, salted meat, bully beef, food like that. You'd almost say vegans need not apply. but in the cabin, they often took livestock on board.
Mm.
They'd have some sheep, and they would be killed during the course of the voyage, so they would eat fresh meat in the cabin. But it was all salted meat, mainly in the steerage compartments.
The biggest problem would have been, I mean, keeping the water from going off, because it would have been in wooden casks, would it?
Well, the water, the ships actually had condensers on them as well. They would distill seawater, yeah.
I didn't realise that.
Yeah.
So they were quite advanced.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Now, when they landed, finally, some were fortunate, some weren't. And can you tell us, do you know what happened to some of those migrants when they finally landed?
Well, I followed up on them to see how they all turned out. And, you know, the big question was, did New Zealand get the right sort of people, the people that they were looking for? And I think, broadly speaking, the answer to that question is yes. Of course, were some riotous exceptions, which caused great scandal when they arrived with boatloads of disreputable people. But
yes,
there weren't that many of them. And most of them fulfilled their dream and did what they intended to do when they came here. Some of them met with tragedy.
Yes.
Most notably Mary Doby, who was murdered in Taranaki in 1880.
Oh.
And others, you know, founded family dynasties who are still with us today.
Still going strong.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a wonderful thing, really. And I suppose England had a population explosion, because I know a lot of families, with the large number of children, if they had a farm, for instance, a farm could sustain maybe one or two sons, but not more than that. So they either had to join the church or head off to the colonies.
Yeah, you're thinking more in terms of the aristocracy there, I think.
Oh, right.
A lot of the people who came during the Vogel period were, in fact, farm workers who had been losing their jobs because of mechanisation and because of the changing arrangements of the rural economy. And so they were looking for an outlet.
And the land clearances in Scotland?
That was a bit earlier.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, because my ones, of course, they came a little bit earlier.
That's right, yeah. The ones I focused on were from 1870 to 1885, which are broadly called the Vogel migrants.
Yes.
And they are very, very significant in the ancestry of today's Pākehā population of New Zealand.
Yes.
And you meet them all the time. I meet them all the time.
People at Waipu and places
yes,
like that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And of course, Dunedin.
Yes, yes.
And Invercargill.
Well, Dunedin, Invercargill, Wellington, Auckland. Yeah. They went everywhere. Yeah.
Yes. Well, David, your book covers every aspect of life on the migrant ships, and I found it so interesting. And it gave me a much greater appreciation of just how courageous my forebears, William and Mary Louisa, were. So thank you so much. The book was fascinating.
Okay, it's a pleasure.
And we're going to finish the program today with God Speed You on Your Way. Now, this was written by Shirley Arena Murray, who was born in Invercargill in 1931. As we have a little more time left, we're going to play Haste Ye Back. And David, thank you once more.
It's a pleasure.
Today, listen every second Wednesday of the month at 2:10 p.m. or download us anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/DecoRetro. And we would like to thank our sponsors, Club Modern, Art Deco Society Auckland. We will keep you informed of all future exciting and glamorous events to be held by Club Modern. For more information, email judith.moore650@gmail.com. That's judith.moore, M-O-O-R-E, 650@gmail.com. Bye for now.